Last week we talked about this is like preparing for the new year. New year is 2020. There's a symmetry to that. It sounds so cool. And so I thought I'd do what probably 8,000 churches are doing already right now. It's like, oh, this is a year where we get 2020 vision. I think it's cool still, even though it's used and it's easy. But we want to make sure that we're starting out the year with the right kind of vision, with a vision that can captivate us, truly captivate us. And so I want to kind of give you guys, a little bit of review, I guess, before we go. Last time when we were together, I shared with you this acronym, that VIM, and it's from Dallas Willard, who, if you don't know who Dallas Willard is, I give you permission to just walk out right now and go buy his book and then and read it instead of listening to this, because it's a lot better. Actually, I don't give you permission to do that. Just do that later, okay? But he has this acronym in one of his books called VIM, at like VIM and vigor. You know, how do we actually experience the kind of life change that's going to result in the abundant life that Jesus promised us? And there's a reliable pattern for how we change our life, and that is three parts. The V stands for vision. First, you have to have a vision that's actually compelling, that actually captures your heart, that really gets you the deepest place, like, I want that. I want that so bad. And that's what we're going to talk about today. But secondly, you also have to have the intention. And yes, I spelled it right this time because there's a spell check. If you remember last time, I had an S in there or something. But intention, you actually have to want to change. You actually have to intend to change and make a plan to say, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be like Jesus, because it's a long road. It's a joyful road. It actually should be an easy road, because Jesus said, my burden is easy, my yoke is light, or the other way around. But you get the picture, right? That this world and a whole lot of leaders and legalism and everything, that can lay a huge burden on our shoulders. And we say, we just have to follow these rules, we have to behave rightly, and then we'll be okay. Well, that drives people to despair. And that's not going to help anybody. Jesus says, come to me, you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest, right? So following Jesus, although it's demanding, although there's a giant leap from where we are, many of us, where I am, to where Jesus is, even though it requires a great degree of intentionality and effort to get there, it should be restful. It should be easy. It should be joyful as we strive with all our energy. It's kind of like, I think of it like playing, right? You watch children play. Do they work when they play? They do, actually. They do a lot of work. Planning and preparation, my kids do, maybe you didn't do it, you know, but a lot of work, and if you're running outside or something, like you're playing, that's work, but it doesn't feel like work, does it? That's the way following Jesus should be. It should be fun. It should be like play. Yeah, I don't know if that works for you, but I was just thinking about that. But it doesn't stop with just having a vision and just intending to change, because the world, we often think, oh, New Year's coming, I'm going to make a resolution, and all I need is enough, I have intention, and then I have willpower, and that will equal change. Wrong. Wrong. Anyone who's ever tried to overcome a bad habit knows that will not sustain you. It might sustain you for a day, or 2 days, or a week, or a month if you're lucky, but not forever, not long term. And we're on a long journey, a long obedience in the same direction, to borrow a phrase from Eugene Peterson. We need a means to actually get there, a reliable means. So I want to start this year off with a vision month and a half, where we look at what are we about as a church, and how are we actually going to achieve this idea of Christ-likeness and what achieve our mission as a church. So I'm going to break it up into, let's see, what is it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Six different, I should have made a seventh one just to have the seven, you know. But six different messages at the beginning of the year to try to give everybody, let's get all on the same page. Say, let's rally together. Are you with me? Let's do this as a team, as a church. And today, I want to look at that first one. What is the vision that we're looking at? If we need to know where we're going, we need to have a story that captivates us. And so we have been looking at this for quite a long time. And if this is not, if this is new to you, awesome. But this may not be new to you. We have this map. If you're going on a journey, here's another mixed metaphors here, right? Vision and now map. You need a map. You need to know where you're going. You need a compass. You need, well, maybe you just need a phone, right? But you need, the Wapato map is this mission advancement plan, how we're actually going to achieve our mission. And there's three components of our map at Wapato. There's our mission, understanding what our mission is. There's understanding our strategy. We actually have a strategy that we want to put in place to accomplish that mission. And closely related to that strategy is we have to return to some structures that we might have forgotten about. Some ancient social church structures that are going to help us strategically to accomplish our mission. And say no to all the other stuff that lies outside of it, that lies on the cutting room floor. So there are three aspects to it, and I'm only going to look at one this morning. Three elements to each of those three aspects. So I'm just giving you the broad picture here. This morning we'll look at our mission. And I'm going to tell you right ahead of time what our mission is. But before we look at our mission, we have to determine the answer, answer the question, what is God's mission? What is God up to in the world? And I'm telling you right now what it is. And then you can see it. Then we'll go through scripture and you can see it. God is on a mission. This is what the biblical story tells us. That God is on a mission to restore everything under his rule. Under his heavenly rule. There's that idea of kingdom, kingdom, kingdom all throughout Jesus' language. And that's Jesus' main message. He came to establish God's rule, his kingdom, and he wants every single component of creation to fall under that rule. It's a life-giving rule. It's a good rule. It's a gracious rule. There's a lot to it, but that is really what the whole Bible is talking about, and I'll prove it to you. That's what all I'm going to do today is look at the biblical story from beginning to sort of end. So you can see, what is this story about? I'm telling you, this is what it's about. And if you don't believe that, that's fine. You got some time, you know, to figure it out. But that's what we want to, this is where we want to go as a church. This is our vision. If this vision doesn't captivate you, I don't know what will. Because this is everything right here. All right? You guys ready to go for this, on this journey? All right. Oh, you're ready. All right. Now, I've actually used some of these graphics before. But let's look at the biblical story to see what God's mission is and then to see what our mission is in light of that. So at the beginning, the story opens up with a bunch of chaotic waters that God has to part. So here's God. Okay, he's not white. He doesn't have a beard and he's not surrounded by naked baby angels. But bear with me, okay, right? We have to have some representatives. So the Sistine Chapel, we'll use that one, all right? There's God and he creates a good, ordered world out of these chaotic waters. And he has just this beautiful, abundant, glorious world that he gets to live in. And then he creates some people. And again, they're not white and they're not made of clay. But I have to have something, all right? You don't want anything to be too real. So they're covered up, I promise, even if you can't see it and you're like, what is that on the... Just don't look too carefully, all right? These human beings are made in God's image. That means they are his statues, his idols, his representatives, kind of like a mirror. So when he looks at human beings, he's seeing himself reflected back. We are meant to represent him in his world. And he plants us in this garden. He has a garden that he makes in the east of Eden. This place means delight. And he plants us in there in order to work it and till it. And there's all these rivers that flow through it. It's actually a garden on a mountain, if you're carefully reading the text. So God plants us in the on his mountain garden where he lives, like the high place. And he says, I'm creating you in my image in order to do what? Do you remember? To be fruitful and rule. Rule. So that crown is representing a rule. That's our purpose. That's the purpose of humanity. To rule the world in partnership with God as his divine representatives on earth. That is a high, high calling. And rule doesn't mean to dominate and exploit and, misuse resources and misuse people. And it does not mean that, as we will see. The whole biblical story is actually anti that. That's what we would naturally do. But that's not what God wants us to do. The picture of gardening is a perfect picture to display what it looks like to rule the world. It means to order the world, to manage the world, to cultivate this world, to bring more abundance and fruitfulness and blessing to all things. That's what ruling, that's what God's kingdom looks like. So the kingdom of God is on page one, right? God's heavenly rule is right there at the very beginning. He created us to do that, right there. And if you don't see it, woe unto you, I guess. No, not woe unto you. But we have this. Then God said, let us make man in our image, or human in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over all the earth. God blessed them. God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule. There's so much here. So much here we could talk about, but we will leave it here. Sounds great, but by the third chapter, there is an enemy that enters into the picture, right? A serpent. And whether that is a literal talking serpent or just a symbol of maybe the evil one himself, you decide, okay? But there is a serpent who is a beast of the field, one of the things that we're supposed to rule over. But this beast tempts us and says, you know what? You don't have to. God's actually holding out on you. You don't have to do this according to God's way. You can actually do this according to your own way. He wants you to be gods. Oh, whoops, I'm tangled up in a cord here. He wants you, he knows that if your eyes will be open, you'll be like God. And so he tempts us and we buy into the trap. And we choose to rule the world on our own terms, independently of God. And so that fractures the relationship between us and God, obviously. But it also destroys the way that we're meant to relate to the creation itself. And the way that God can now relate to the creation itself. It messes everything up. The reverberations of that ripple effect. I mean, it affects every single part of this whole thing. But even in the midst of this, there is a promise. So our image, our ability to reflect God in the way that we rule has been shattered in some way. We still kind of reflect him because we're still his image bearers, but we're not doing it properly. Every once in a while, we get it right, but it's few and far between. It's like a shattered mirror. You can still see something in there, but not, you know, if your hair is going to get out of place or something like that. So our rule has been tainted, but the good news is that God exiled us. That's not the good news. He exiled us from this garden, from his presence, from our ability to eat from the tree of life and live forever. But this is the good news, that one day someone, oh, that's not supposed to appear there, but that's all right. Don't worry about it. That there will be this one who comes and crushes the head of the serpent. And as he puts a seed of the woman, a son that will crush the head of the serpent, and as he crushes, delivers that death blow to the source of evil and corruption in our world, he gets bit on the heel. So it's like you die as you deliver the death blow. Obviously, crushing the head is a lot worse than crushing a heel. But we know that there's going to be a battle between a certain type of people and the serpent, and then this one. And so, anyway, if we want to look at this, the story moves on. And eventually, all humans here, we're all ruling. We've multiplied a lot. And we've moved to this plain in Shinar, and we start building the city that is actually called Babylon. This is Genesis chapter 11. So it says Babel in most of our translations. In fact, I'm not aware of a translation that actually translates the word. We just transliterate it. But it's a city that we're building, trying to come together and establish some security and something for ourselves. And we build it all the way up to heaven, kind of like repairing that rift between that garden, mountain, heaven and earth relationship that we used to have. It's a way to do that on our own terms, right? To exalt ourselves up to that level again. God's like, not on my watch, okay? So what we're going to do is now I'm going to scatter you. You stop building this city, and you're scattered all over, you know, the world. And this is the beginning of these nations, these people groups. People groups, by the way, it's really not nations like a nation state or anything at the beginning. These are just families. These are large clans of people. So all these ethnos, all these ethnicities and nations and everything scattered over the face of the earth. So this is a big problem. Because if we rule on our own terms, it looks terrible. But God chooses this guy. He puts an end to Babylon. But out of the same place, he chooses this guy. That's my best Abraham, okay? This guy named Abraham, out of Ur of the Chaldeans, which is basically the same place as Babylon. And he says, hey, I'm going to make a promise with you and your family. So all the people that come for you, that's not supposed to happen. I don't know why that happens. It never happens in my thing. I'm going to mess that. I got to change that. Anyway, so what's happening here is that God makes a promise, a covenant with Abraham and his family. And he says, hey, so when you, you leave your father's household and that land, and you go to the land that I will show you. I'm going to give this land to you as an inheritance, a place, like an experiment, great experiment. You leave everything that you know, and you go into this land, and I'm going to give you this land. I'm going to make you great. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to make you into a great nation. And through your family, through your nation, I am going to bless every family on the face of the earth. So it's like a restoration of the blessing that we used to have in the very beginning. God is pursuing that through a single family. He chooses one family to bless all the whole rest of the world and get back this partnership that he used to have that results in blessing for the world. Make sense so far? Are you with me? Yeah? Okay. Okay. I am seeing nodding heads. I don't just say it to hear myself talk. But Abraham goes down to a land called Egypt, right? And eventually his family multiplies like gangbusters. And they multiply so much that the king of Egypt is threatened by them. And he starts enslaving them and trying to kill them, right? He's killing off these people and enslaving them, keeping them under his thumb. This is the first picture of what a full-blown kind of kingdom looks like in the Bible. A kingdom of our own making. And it looks like exploitation and abuse and murder, genocide. I mean, this is bad stuff. In fact, it's linked to Babylon. You know, what are they making? Bricks? What did Babylon, in Babylon, they had the new technology. It's called the brick, right? And there, anyway, I won't go into all the details. But it's bad. It's real bad. And so all God's people are crying out, help! We need to be saved from this. So God shows up, and he remembers his covenant with Abraham and his family. And this is the first time, besides actually in the opening chapters, that God is portrayed explicitly as a king in the Bible. And so he puts on his crown, and he goes to work doing what a king does, which is to confront evil and to liberate his people from its effects and invite them to live under his rule. That's what he does. Confront evil, liberate his people, and invite them to live under his rule. And so what does he do? He puts an end. He gives them 10 chances to say, just let my people go. We can work this out peacefully. let my people go who you unjustly enslaved. And the king says, no, I don't think so. 10 times. So he sends 10 plagues to them. And each time he hardens his heart, and it's just a terrible thing. So eventually God says, it's over. Your firstborn sons are dead, just like you tried to kill my firstborn son, Israel. And now you're all wiped out. You know, you probably know the story of that whole exodus from Egypt. It's such a beautiful but bloody story. So the kingdom of Egypt is no more, this human kingdom. God exerts his rule. And there's this great song at the end of it in Exodus 15, where it says, I will sing to Yahweh, for he is highly exalted. The horse and its rider he has hurled into the sea. Yahweh is my strength and song. He has become my salvation. Your right hand, O Yahweh, is majestic in power. Your right hand, O Yahweh, shatters the enemy. And in the greatness of your excellence, you overthrow those who rise up against you. Terror and dread fall upon our enemies. By the greatness of your arm, they are motionless as stone until your people pass over, O Yahweh, until the people pass over whom you have purchased. You will bring them and plant them in the mountain of your inheritance. What's that? If we've been reading the Bible, we would, our minds should go all the way back to the beginning of the story. Genesis, plant them on the mountain of your... Okay, interesting. The place, O Yahweh, which you have made for your dwelling, the sanctuary, O Yahweh, which your hands have established, Yahweh shall reign, rule, kingdom, forever and ever. So when Moses and Miriam are singing this song and leading the, after they've experienced this great deliverance, this great liberation, they interpret it as God exerting his rule, like, oh, he's inviting us now to come back to Eden. And so what does that look like? They go journey into the desert for a few days. God's still king here, all right? And they go to this Mount Sinai, right? And God invites them up to meet with him. To actually, the whole nation is supposed to come up the mountain when the ram's horn blasts and meet with him on the third day, and they get all afraid. So here is Israel here at the bottom of the mountain. We'll just call them Israel. They're in modern attire, but just don't worry about that. I can't find a picture of ancient Israelite groups or something like that. But anyway, he calls them in Exodus 19. He calls them a priestly kingdom. What does a priest do? Anybody know? It's like, yeah, it represents people before God. It's a mediator. It's a mediatory role. So you're representing people before God, but you're also representing God before the people. It almost goes both ways. So it's like you're a go-between between God and people. That's an important role. So the whole nation of Israel is meant to represent all the nations before God and also display God to all of the nations. So they are a priestly kingdom. They're supposed to rule, just like the priest kings in the garden. I didn't mention the priest part, but anyway, we don't want too many details, okay? So he gives them his Torah, which at the time is just obey my voice. But then it gets bigger and bigger and bigger the more they show themselves unable to follow this. So God says, okay, if you live under my rule, expressed in my commandments, my Torah, then you will be this priestly kingdom to the nations. He even says it here. Now then, this is Exodus 19. Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. So what is this supposed to look like? Here's a good word picture. And this is a word picture that Isaiah uses. And the idea behind it is that if we look at this world is a dark world, kind of like we talked about a little bit earlier in the service. The nations are blind. They're living in darkness. Every once in a while, you stumble on the right path, even though you're blind, but you have no idea where you're going. You don't know how to live. You have no life inside you. You're cut off. You're in exile. And priestly kingdom of Israel is supposed to be like a light in this dark world. So that when you look at Israel, you say, oh, that's what Yahweh's like. Oh, that's how he wants me to live. Oh, okay, so I can come to know Yahweh through this priestly kingdom. And so God's like, yeah, let's do this. Let's partner up here. But instead of being a priestly kingdom, they become a kingdom with priests, which is a problem. It's immediate. He's like, you'll be my priestly kingdom. And then all of a sudden, they've got priests almost immediately. It shows us that they are in need of a mediator just like every single nation on earth. They're no better than anybody else. So it becomes a kingdom of Israel, sure, but that priestly role kind of gets altered a bit because they need those priests. So eventually God, they disobey him and God moves out town. This is hundreds of years of disobedience if you know the biblical story. And God leaves his people to suffer the fate that they have lie in the grave that they dug for themselves. Their kingdom becomes smaller and smaller and less glorious, and as they disobey God's Torah and don't live under his rule. And eventually, the light goes out. They look just like every single other nation. And when they're exiled to all the other nations, there's nothing to distinguish them from any other nation. And eventually, the kingdom status is basically obliterated. David's line, this great king that he made this covenant with, that is lost, all but lost. There's nothing distinguishing them. So this is the situation. They may come back into their own land, but Yahweh's not there. They don't have a king. They can't rule. They can't live under the Torah anymore. This is the situation that Jesus enters into. Jesus comes on the scene here. And everybody's listening to him, right? And he comes preaching this message of God's restored kingdom. That Jesus came into Galilee announcing God's good news. The time is fulfilled, he said. God's kingdom is arriving. Turn back and believe the good news. So Jesus presents himself as the king of God's kingdom, the Messiah, the anointed king that all these prophecies start talking about, this coming king. And he perfectly reflects God as a human being, as the human one, as the Adam, which means human, as a new Israelite, an Israelite who can faithfully live under God's Torah and reflect God's character as he rules. So what does it look like? What kind of thing, when Jesus presents himself as king, remember, what is he confronting? And what is he liberating people from? And what kind of a rule is he inviting people into? Well, what are people dealing with when you read the Gospels? They're possessed or oppressed or whatever by evil spirits. They are in a state of ritual impurity. They are far from the presence of God and with no means to even repair that relationship. Come on in. They are in bondage. They are going to die. They're suffering from all the effects of death and sin in the world, disease and paralysis and sickness. And Jesus comes to confront all that stuff, even wind and waves. Remember Genesis 1? Like the chaotic waters that threaten God's good world, he is come to deal with. He even quiets storms and winds and waves. He sets right all of these things. He's confronting evil at its source and the effects of evil. He has come to crush the head of the serpent. And he does away with all this. And so he is restoring this priestly kingdom of Israel. We call it the church. Okay? It's his people, God's people, living under his rule. And he says, this is what it looks like. Where does he outline it most clearly? Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7. What I call his kingdom manifesto, what is commonly known as the Sermon on the Mount. What does it look like to live under the rule of God? Well, we endure, maybe even enjoy, or have joy within persecution. We are peacemakers. We refuse to hate. We refuse to harbor bitterness. We have not only no adultery, but we have no lust, no unholy desire for something that we shouldn't have. We have complete integrity. We refuse to retaliate in kind or repay evil with evil. We love our enemies. We forgive those who wrong us. We don't worry. We don't have anxiety. We refuse to condemn others. We have an attitude of servitude and humility and trying to get under people. I'm not saying anything you don't already know. You read the Gospels. This is Jesus inside and out. But this kingdom looks so different. It's the antithesis to every human kingdom, isn't it? Every human kingdom is like the top-down rule, where I exert my dominance and my power and my authority over you, and you know what? You're my peons, so whatever. I can do whatever I want with you, and I can enslave you, and I can abuse you, and I can mistreat you or manipulate you for my own ends. Jesus is like, no, you can't do any of that. You have to be freed from that. I've come to liberate you from those forces, because that's the way the source, the serpent, is whispering in your ear, getting you to rule the world on your own terms. You can't listen to him anymore. Come to me. You must believe that I am the Messiah. And guess what? That gets him killed. But far from an accident. This is no accident. This is the place where he crushes the head of the serpent by letting the serpent do its worst to him. Kill him unjustly on a tree. And he puts an end to the serpent's dominion over us. This is such good stuff. And so if we go back to this, I'm just really quickly, briefly going through this. If we go back to our VIM thing, our vision, our intention, our means, this is a vision that has to captivate us. We have to get this in our heads and in our hearts. It has to be at the top of our mind all the time. We have to be living out of this vision. How do we live into this vision? And this is what I mean when I say this is God's mission. God is on a mission. The whole biblical story, I hope you can see it. I hope you can. I say this so often, I feel like a broken record, and I hate repeating myself, but I should get used to it because I have kids, young kids, and you have to repeat yourself many, 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 many times with young children. But it's the same for all of us, right? It takes so many times until we finally get it. Come on in. Come on in, kids. Mentioning kids. This is God's mission. So what is our mission? And I promise I am wrapping up here. What is our mission? Our mission, then, if that is God's mission, our mission is to represent that rule, to actually become the kind of humans that can image him by following Jesus, to represent his rule and to advance his rule in our world, whatever world we find ourselves in. Maybe that's just Gaston for us. Maybe that's our little piece of the world that we're responsible for. And so if we break this down, I want you to remember three missional imperatives. And if we break it down, our mission is broken down into three main elements. And then we'll take some communion together, all right? Three main elements. Number one, represent Jesus. Become his apprentice. Become someone who, when they realize the way you think and the things that you meditate on, the words that you say, your actions, everything displays Jesus to them. We have to display Jesus to the world, to bear witness to Jesus in everything that we think, our attitudes, and what we do say. We have to represent Jesus. We have to do that. That's our first imperative, the first thing that we do. So when we're thinking about our mission, the vision for the church, we want to represent Jesus, and we want to, two, advance his good news, advance his gospel. That means forth-tell this good news, but also to expand it out from there. This is good news that needs to be told to the last little dark corner in the world, which has not happened yet. So we can't just keep it to ourselves. We can't just tell our neighbors about it. Some of us actually have to go. And we have to go to the farthest places that we can think of, the people that would never hear this good news. It has to be advanced and has to be preached. And then the third thing is, we make more apprentices until this whole world is filled with little Jesuses and the kingdom of God comes in its fullness. That's the whole plan. Jesus' plan is for world domination. I know that that sounds weird. Not world domination like we think it. World domination by becoming like him and persuading other people, hey, you should live this way too. It's voluntary, right? But that's the great thing about it. We are entrusted with the task of making more copies of Jesus. So we have to become, again, one, represent Jesus. Become a copy of Jesus yourself. Display him to the world. Two, advance the gospel. And three, make more copies. Make more apprentices of Jesus. Can we get those? Can you black it out? I don't know if you can black it out. You probably can't black it out. But if we go back through it, oh, you did it. Good job. Do you remember the three elements of our mission? What's one? Represent Jesus. All right, what's two? Advance the gospel. What's three? Make apprentices. You guys are good. You guys, thank you for actually listening to me. That was awesome. Can I go back in here and yeah, I can. Oh, thank you. So next week, just a preview here, we're going to look at the strategy for how we actually accomplish that mission. It's not enough to say, all right, I got the map. I got the vision. We need a means to accomplish that. And strategy is talking about that means. So I'm actually going to be spending 3 weeks on the strategy because it's that important. So that's just a little heads up reminder. Audrey, would you come up here and we are going to spend a few minutes celebrating communion together. So sermon is over.